Last month, in July, SBMG, sort of on short notice, one of their teachers couldn't show up, so they asked me to speak about something. And I was actually preparing the topic already for tonight. Tonight's a full moon night, and that's a special observance that Boogie's going to tell us more about later on. But I thought it'd be a good time to talk about devotion. So a lot of my talks are sort of, you know, getting down into the scholarship of the suttas or whatever, but there's a whole different aspect of the practice, really, that involves letting go into devotion. So we'll talk about that tonight. And for those that were at SBMG, I apologize. It'll be a little bit different. I see a few of you. But it really addresses what are we about at SIM also. So how many people were here last week for Tony Bernhardt? Yeah, about half. That's great. So as you know, he is a secular Buddhist, self-identified secular Buddhist. And he spent quite a bit of time, he was talking about the refuges, the refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And he spent quite a bit of time sort of distancing his remarks from the devotional, right? Remember, he kept saying, oh, this is really a practice of investigation. This isn't about devotion. This, okay. So it's really a perfect setup for this week. So we, you know, this community, as well as the Zen Sangha that meets on Monday nights, Valley Streams, came out of SBMG. SBMG, Sacramento Buddhist Meditation Group, has been going since, I think, 1991, and was formed as a multi-tradition Buddhist meditation group so that people could practice in the Theravadin tradition, the insight tradition that we practice here, in the Vajrayana tradition, the sometimes called Tibetan, and then the Zen tradition. And they bring in teachers, very well-known teachers, in all three of those traditions on their Sunday night meetings here in this building. And it's a fantastic group. And with time, various people decided that they wanted to go more deeply into one tradition or another. So what happened with this group is that Dennis Warren and a few others decided they wanted to go more deeply into the insight or Vipassana tradition. Now, this insight of Vipassana tradition was brought over here to this country by Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Jack Engler, a few others that had traveled to Asia and had found this practice, but felt at that time that bringing in some of the more devotional stuff would put people off. Now, this was the 60s, and there was sort of a backlash against traditional religion. So they teach the tradition very much true to the way it's taught in Asia, but they sort of emphasize meditation more than it's emphasized in Asia, and they emphasize the first two steps that people are usually taught there, the dana, which we heard Sarah talking about, and the sila, which is ethical living, they emphasize those less. And my understanding is that they were afraid that if they led with, oh, well, this is all about ethical living, that people would be kind of put off and think it was like the Ten Commandments or an extension of the religion they'd left behind. And there's quite a bit of searching and seeking at that time for Eastern religion, and also for higher states of consciousness, which, various media were used to achieve that at that time, and still are. But I think that's part of why meditation caught on so much, was that it has the potential to produce non-ordinary states, right? So that's just a little bit of historical background of why maybe we haven't heard that much about devotion. So in my own practice, you know, I've been a spiritual seeker my whole life, and I found this practice in the early part of this millennium. And was drawn to kind of the clarity of the teachings, the way that the teachings are presented in this tradition, and the simplicity of the meditation. You know, it's just like we were doing with the guiding, just be there for whatever's present, right? There's a little more to it than that, but that's the basis. If we could let go of everything, that's all we would need to do. And so I was quite drawn to the kind of secular aspect of it, the study aspects of it, learning about the suttas and learning about how these were handed down to us and all of that, maybe less drawn to the devotional. So fast forward about 4 years into my practice, in 2007 I went on pilgrimage. And I don't see anybody else from the 2007 pilgrimage, but there are a number of you here from the 2014 pilgrimage, and I know a number of others here who go to Asia on their own to practice, and it's a different deal over there. So these images on the altar are some examples of things you might see when you're in Asia and you go to temples, places of worship, if you will, Buddhist temples, and you'll see some people doing their practices, and then you'll see some buildings and some altars and some various things there. So that's all available. These are all, I think they're all from Thailand. The practice of being on pilgrimage really changed my practice. First of all, when you're in India and you're wanting a nice quiet place to practice, forget it. It doesn't exist. So I don't know if you noticed how quiet it was in here tonight in our meditation. And, you know, I think part of that is just the setting, the fact that it encourages that. And I think part of it's the intention. Honestly, I think many of us come here as a refuge from all of the crassness and the vulgarity and the violence, quite frankly, that's happening in our world today. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I feel privileged that we can offer that here, a refuge from all of that. And actually, all of that crassness and vulgarity and violence is part of the reason I'm interested in devotion, is that it offers a frame of mind that is different from all of that, that crassness and vulgarity. And I'll get into that a little bit more. Let me get back to pilgrimage for a bit. So don't expect a quiet place. There's going to be horns honking. There's going to be people hawking their wares. There's going to be loudspeakers, maybe even playing Buddhist chants. But if you don't understand the language, it could just as well be an advertisement coming over a not very high-quality speaker. There's just constant coming and going. And that is a real benefit, because the idea that we can only meditate when we have the perfectly silent place and there are no quote-unquote distractions, although I know you've heard me say many times, in this practice there are no distractions, because everything is an equally valid object of our attention, right? But over there, forget about avoiding distractions. It's one big circus, if you will. There are just three rings of activity and color and smell and things going on. So it's quite stimulating when your eyes are open. And even when your eyes are closed, I remember one time we were sitting in a little circle around a Thai temple in India, and opened our eyes, and there was this whole group of kids that had come around and sort of come into our circle and were, you know, looking at us, and it was just, wow, you know, really, really fun stuff. And the thing that really changed my practice was seeing Buddhists from other countries traveling to India. We just did the pilgrimage circuit, right? This wasn't the Taj Mahal and, you know, going to Bollywood movies in Mumbai or anything like that. This was like Bihar province, the poorest province in all of India, and cites that the Buddha in one of his suttas recommended that people visit. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is Digha Nikaya 16, the long discourses, number 16, and it is a long discourse. It's like, you know, before the Buddha died, it's the story of the Buddha's death, or Parinibbana. And I think they decided, the compilers, you know, this obviously didn't happen in the order that it's in this sutta, but the compilers decided, boy, we better get everything in there, you know, before the Buddha dies. So it's full of stuff. But one of the things that he said is that there are four places on Ananda that a pious Ananda was his attendant and his cousin, who was with him for 40, 45 years. Ananda, that a pious person should visit and look upon with feelings of reverence. Okay, that's what we're looking for, feelings of reverence here. Tonight is about feeling, not about acquiring another piece of knowledge. What are the four? Basically, the four are Limbini, Bodhgaya, Sarnath, and Kushinagar. So when you read the suttas, it'll often say, you know, thus have I heard, you know, 500 monks were gathered at Sarnath and this happened. Or 500 monks were gathered at Savatthi, or all of these places that were recommended. So Lumbini is the place where the Buddha was born, which is, it's actually now in Nepal, but they're all in the Ganges plain. Bodhgaya is the place where he was enlightened. Sarnath is where he gave his first talk to the five ascetics that he had been practicing with before, his first three talks. And then Kushinagar is the place where he died, where he went into Parinibbana. And so you go to these places and you see these pilgrims. Now, you know, the Thai tourists come up in their big, fancy, air-conditioned buses, and they get off with these beautiful yellow clothing, and you know, everything's very well attended to. The ones that really got to me were the Sri Lankans. So the Sri Lankans are dressed in very plain gray cloth. They have their monks and nuns with them. They all chant together. So whenever we would sit in these sites, these ones that we just mentioned and some others, I'd always try to go over by them, because their chanting was just magical. And you could tell that these folks had saved every penny to be able to do this trip. These were not wealthy folks. And it was so inspirational to see the sincerity of their practice, because, I mean, it's a circuit, right? You go from one to the other, because there's kind of a logical order to it. So we'd bump into them, you know, three or four or five times along the road and see them again. And just super inspirational to see these folks and others practicing. So we sometimes in the West, given our religious backgrounds, often Christianity, we sometimes mistake these postures of reverence for some kind of worship of a god, right? Because that's what it looks like to us. People are putting their hands together and they're walking around and they're bowing and so forth. And what I want to convey tonight is that what we're talking about is a feeling of reverence. So we actually do a number of devotional things here that you may not have even noticed. So I'm just going to kind of go through the list and have you think about them. So we took our shoes off when we came in here, right? Now, you might just think of that as, well, everybody else is doing it, so I'll do it. And if you didn't do it and you have shoe covers on, that's fine, by the way. But when you look at that practice of taking one's shoes off before entering a space, that's about humility. For me, it's about humility. You can frame it any way you want. But it's, to me, it's more than just the peer pressure of everybody else is doing it. I think I'll take my shoes off. It's actually a feeling of humility. We're taking off our shoes. We're entering a space kind of changed from what we were out there in the foyer. And the way, to me, one of the ways that we're changed in doing that is humility. We're closer to the earth. Humility comes from the same word as humus. It's the soil, the earth. I'm a soil scientist, so trust me on this one. It's actually getting closer to the earth, right? We don't have that shoe or sock in between us and the ground. We have a carpet and a building, but you get the idea. We have all these prayer flags out here, you know, and again, those can sort of become background, or you see them, and a lot of people have them now, especially in Midtown. You might notice them floating around in people's lofts and things like that. I've got some on my altar here. This, by the way, is a very small portion of the stuff I have at home on my altar. And you can come up and look at it later. But prayer flags. So, okay, prayer flags. They aren't actually from our tradition at all, right? They're a Buddhist practice, but they're from the Vajrayana tradition. So when you go to pretty much anywhere in Asia, you'll see these prayer flags now, but they came from the Vajrayana tradition. Gus, is the writing on them Tibetan, usually?
Yeah.
So they're written in Tibetan, and they have images of, to use the Western improper word, deities, but they're embodiments of various characteristics that we aspire to on the flags, and then a little message about them. The colors are significant. They symbolize the environment. They symbolize water, sky, clouds, earth, and fire. And they are meant to fall apart. That's why we leave them up. That's why we let them fade from all these brilliant colors, which have all this meaning, down to a neutral gray, the same color as those robes that those Sri Lankans are wearing. Just a neutral gray as a result of the sun and the wind and the rain. We allow them to fade to remind us of impermanence. So more than just a pretty decoration or something on your balcony that says, oh, I know that Buddhism exists, or, you know, or I'm a practicing Buddhist and I love it, or whatever you're saying when you put them out in front of your house, they remind us that, like us, these flags are being worn with time, with the elements, and will eventually fade away. The other meaning of them, which again ties us with Buddhists all over the world, is that they're prayer flags, right? They contain, and again, when you talk to people over there, they, oh, I came to the temple today to pray. Well, what does that really mean? It means that we're cultivating thoughts and intentions toward characteristics that we aspire to. It means that we honor the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. We have reverence for them. You know, it doesn't mean that we're worshiping them as something that's higher than us or anything like that. It just means that we're offering reverence. We're offering honor. We're offering a recognition that if we had these characteristics, we would suffer less, right? That's what the practice is about, the ending of suffering. So Buddhists all over the world have those same intentions. And the prayer flags are a symbol as the wind blows through them. And when you see them up on mountaintops in Tibet, believe me, they're not hanging limp like they are today in August in Sacramento. They are, you know, 24/7, 365, there's wind that's blowing through those flags that's carrying, metaphorically, carrying the message of those flags throughout the world, right? So that's what we're doing here. We're sharing whatever positive intentions we're holding here for Buddhists, people that are practicing like us, or people that aren't, just the world in general, the metta that we offer, the dedication of merit that we offer. Those are forms of prayers. Now, they're not, I think the word in Christianity is supplicatory prayer. Does that sound right? When you're asking for something, you expect to get it? Yeah, supplicatory prayer. That's not what we're doing here. We're offering words of honor. We're offering metta. We're offering these characteristics that we're aspire to develop in our own selves and in our practice. And these flags are carrying those aspirations, if you will, beyond our small little space here. We have Buddha images, right? This particular one is the down on the altar. Some of you in the back may not be able to see it, but this Buddha here is one that you all gave me when I graduated from the practice development and leadership program with Dennis, with Jeff Harden and Diane in 2008. And you presented that to me afterwards, and then the little necklace thing around it was also given to me by the Sangha for service. So we have these statues. Why do you have these statues? You know, it's not to worship them. It's, again, to aspire to the characteristics that this human being, this Buddha, had that we aspire to. We want to develop our ethics. We want to develop our patience. We want to develop our wisdom. We want to develop all of those characteristics, the paramis, if you will, so that we suffer less. Same thing. Buddha said, I teach one thing and one thing only. So all these devotional practices are about one thing and one thing only, suffering less. Okay? And then I always try to have an image of the feminine, and this is one of the few that we actually have in our tradition. You know, for a while we had the Kuan Yin back here, but this is Mahapajapati, and she was the Buddha's stepmother, right? It was like his aunt, but it was a wet nurse, actually, because his mother died shortly after he was born. And then she later came to him and asked to found an order of nuns. He eventually said yes with Ananda's intervention. That's a story for another day. He eventually said yes. And today we have nuns. And I actually got that from the Alokavihara nuns, that image there. So try to keep an image of the feminine around. Why? Because that represents some qualities that I want to develop in myself. What else? You know, in Catholic Church, we used to joke about smells and bells. Well, we have bells in this tradition, too. And I brought a few, and tonight, if you stay afterwards, we'll do a little sound meditation. But, you know, we ring three bells at the end of the sitting. Why do we do that? You know, because I don't want to use an alarm clock? No, we do that as a devotional practice. And the three bells represent the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So it's a reminder that we take refuge in those things, and our meditation is a way of approaching those, allowing us to suffer less. We talked a little bit about dana already. One thing you can do in Asia, you can do it here too, but there are many opportunities to do so in Asia, is that you can offer food directly to monastics, to monks and nuns, you know, on the street. Just walk in the street, you can see them coming by, or you can, you know, if one of them's standing in front of a store, you can go in and buy them something to eat or something like that. And that's pretty cool practice. It's really very direct. You know, I mean, I really appreciate folks that put a check into a bowl, but that's fairly indirect, right? But the opportunity to actually hand an offering directly to a monastic is pretty cool. And you can do that here, you can do it. You know, Boogie will talk tonight about Abhayagiri Monastery. The Alokavihara nuns in the fall have a ceremony they call the Katina ceremony, and that's an opportunity to support their work financially or with in-kind gifts. So that's a great practice. It's a devotional practice. Having an altar. So I don't know, some of the other things up here, I'll just go through them quickly. I have a picture of Steve Armstrong and a card that they gave me when I went and practiced at their hermitage. with a little note. Got a couple little Buddha images that either I collected or that others have given me after they've been on pilgrimage. Have a card that, powerful card. This is a card that Susan Orr gave us at the last Climate Sangha. And it's a quote from Roshi Joan Halifax. It's called Grace. So it's one of those poems that the first letter of grace is the first letter of the sentence. Gather attention, recall bodhicitta, that's the mind heart that aspires to awakening, bodhicitta. Intention, awaken and save all beings. Attune to self, sense into body, sense into heart mind, sense into other. Consider what might really serve, engage. I talked about Mahapajapati. This is a incense burner, so that's the smells part of smells and bells. And when we, when our pilgrimage went to Bodh Gaya, there was a service project that was serving the Dalit folks, sometimes called the Untouchables, that had a village outside of Bodh Gaya, and we went and supported their school on this. And then after we did that, Sister Mary Lobo showed up at our hotel with an incense burner for each of us. She was the Catholic nun that was running that project, and she has since died. We used to support that as a sangha, but we're not doing that anymore. Here, lift that up. Yeah, there you go. Thank you. This is a little collage I made for each of the pilgrims from photos that I took on pilgrimage. This is the one I made for myself. So you can come up and look at that. There's pictures on both sides if you want to see that. And this is something that Diane made for all of us. So it's what a great artist she is. So there's drawings of the whole group, and then there's a leaf that she picked up in Bodh Gaya. It's a Bodhi leaf from the Bodhi tree there. So that's just an example of, and then one of her painted rocks over there. And then another reminder of Anicca, some sand from a sand mandala. Because as you know, in the Vajrayana tradition, they build these beautiful colored sand mandalas, and then they destroy them, and they throw them in the river. But they'll often give you a little sample if you ask for it. And then at home, I have some reminders of death. I have some ashes from my father and my sister, and I have a bone mala that one of the pilgrims gave me, Steve Gross. So that's an example of, and then these are katas. These are the scarves that they give when you go to a temple or even to a hotel. They put them around your neck, and it's like a blessing. And they have auspicious symbols on them. If you look closely, they're, I think when I used to wear ties, they called it a jacquard print. You know, it's kind of raised a little bit. So you can take a peek at those afterwards, too. I mentioned the, practice of the Brahma Viharas, the practice of dedicating merit, the refuges and precepts that we'll be chanting later on with Boogie. Those are all devotional practices. So don't take them for granted. Understand that there are, anytime you chant that, there are people all over the world, well, at least in the right time zones for that moment, that are doing the same thing. And so it really binds us together as practitioners. So that's about all I had. I would like to invite you up now and
give you this
and have you talk a little bit about what today is. You want the chair or you want the cushion?
No, I'll sit on the cushion.
Okay.
Thank you, Rich. So the practice of Upasatha predates the Buddha, observing the new moon, the half moon, and the full moon, and the next half moon. It's a good day to go to the monastery. I wanted to say that the Buddha, he kept the practice, he recommended the practice. He said that it was a good way for a layperson to get a taste of what it's like to live as an arahant, a fully awakened being. And so, as I say, in Asia, a lot of people will visit the monastery on those days. And that's where I got exposed to the practice, going to Abhayagiri in Redwood Valley in Mendocino County. That's a really important part of my practice, really special to me. And so every 7 or 8 days, what happens at the monastery is alms round in the morning, and there's no work period that day. Which, by the way, this practice reminds me a little bit of the Sabbath. But later, people get together and chant in Pali and English the three refuges and the eight precepts. That part is a little bit ceremonial or symbolic, because the idea is that you're following those eight precepts all day. And then there is a Dhamma talk by a senior monk, and then people are invited to keep a vigil, alternating walking and sitting meditation. So it was this year that it occurred to me to try doing this practice at home, just kind of keep me connected with the monks and the rhythm of their days over there. It's inspiring to me. And it's kind of like a mini retreat, about once a week. I chant the precepts in the morning before meditation. And what are the precepts? Most of you are probably familiar with the five precepts, I think. I don't think I need to go into those. So the modification, a modification is that instead of not engaging in sexual misconduct for the day, one commits to abstaining from any sexual activity. And also the sixth precept is to basically not eat after noon or not eat after lunch. No beautification, adornment, entertainment, such as singing or dancing. And then the last one is not sleeping in a high or luxurious place. So I like to, on Upasatha days, I like, as a practice, as an exercise, I like to extend those precepts, take them a little more strictly, go a little further with them. So a couple examples of that. With the third precept, Tony Bernhardt last week was saying that in Pali, it's not saying, I will not engage in sexual misconduct. It's not sexual misconduct. It refers to sense pleasures. So it's saying, I will not engage in sensual indulgence. So taking that a little further, so today a friend sent me a picture, a very irreverent picture. It was in Asia, some Buddhist monks, and there was what looked to be an American tourist right there. She was wearing very little clothing. And you could see it looked like the Buddhist monastic was paying a lot of attention to that. So the caption said, all these years of practice, and now this, and it's just out the window, basically. So right now it's summertime, and there's a lot of men and women out there not wearing very much, and some of them might be attractive. So what is one to do? Well, if you want to really work with your sensual desire, where are you looking? Where are your eyes drawn to? Do you have to, you know, do you have to, if that's an issue for you, you can zoom out, not zoom in, just what are you isolating as one particular part of the body? And then one other one would be, instead of just saying the precept of not lying, you can take the whole issue of right speech. And so no divisive speech, no idle chatter. You can extend it. So the sixth precept, following that is really fruitful. That's a funny choice of word. Not eating after noon is really useful for me because a lot of times I will just start eating and then eating more. You know, that's something that I struggle with, is really being kind of a glutton. So when I'm fasting, especially over many days, boy, do I notice that desire, that gluttony, it is really unpleasant, actually. Feeling overstuffed, you know. Benefit is that when you sit and meditate after not eating dinner the night before, your mind settles a lot more. So, an example of not taking it too far is that there's a medication that I'm taking right now. It's supposed to be taken at night with food or milk. So I take it with milk. I wouldn't normally be drinking milk following the sixth precept. Abstaining from entertainment and singing and dancing, this one is really, a lot comes up for me. It's a really useful practice because one little example is I'll often find myself singing a song or whistling. And so can I catch it before it happens? You know, just as an exercise, I refrain from doing it. So maybe I notice after I've already started doing it, I say, oh yeah, that's a reminder, you know, for me to try to be mindful and catch it before it happens. I really like to have to add something extra to what I'm doing. So especially if I'm doing a mundane task, my job is pretty mundane. So if I'm out delivering the mail, that's my job. A lot of times I'll want to be listening to music while I do it or listening to some NPR. You know, I'm not content. You know, I'm craving some more stimulation. So trying to be content is a good practice, and it gives a really peaceful feeling over time. To try to do that. Social media. I really like social media. I'm pretty attached to it, so I refrain from that. So it's a little just exercise some self-control on who posts the days. My son, here's an example of where I draw the line is my son was doing a music and singing class, and so I would be singing and dancing too with him. In the group, and so if that fell on an Uposatha day, I would say, no, I'll go ahead and do it. You know, that would be extreme to me, is to say, no, I won't do it. The eighth precept of high and luxurious place for sleeping, that one I don't follow too strictly. There's nothing luxurious about my bed, but that it is high. So the classic thing would be to sleep on the floor. That's one that I don't usually follow too strictly. So it's also a good day to listen to the Dhamma. So thank you, Rich. You got me covered on that one today. And then I will get a little bit of extra practice in. I have a busy life, so it's usually not too much. I'll do walking meditation, a short one, or do a little bit of chanting. So personally, I really struggle with craving, you know, maybe a lot more than some other people. So this, a lot comes up with these practices for me. And of course, craving is the second noble truth. It's the cause of suffering. So it's pretty central to the practice. And then I like the phrase that, again, Tony Bernhardt uses. He likes to talk about not taking the bait of craving. So I like the intensive practice on Upostha days of not taking the bait. There's this habit of grabbing, just automatically grabbing for what you want. So I'm building a different habit, a habit of renunciation and letting go, just letting that urge pass on its own. And then with right intention, the first right intention is the intention of renunciation. So you're working on that when you're doing this practice. And I really notice with this practice the phenomenon of momentum. When I'm giving in to a lot of urges, there's a momentum that builds up there, carrying me away from the practice. And you know, Upostha is a nice, almost weekly chance to reset that and get a momentum going in the other direction. And again, you know, I find that in so many ways, I act habitually upon having an urge. So in so many ways, these eight precepts, they are a chance to practice being mindful about cutting that automatic connection between urge and action. And so for those who would like to stay tonight, we will. I have some handouts in the back, and that's got chanting. We'll do Pali in English, the three refuges, and the eight precepts. And we will, my idea is that we will alternate walking meditation and sitting meditation. Well, I guess the last thing I'll say is that I hope that this practice, hearing about this practice, and somebody will benefit from wanting to take it up and taking it up and finding it very useful.
Thank you. So, yeah, anybody that wants to stay is welcome to do so. When I do the scheduling, I usually look for full moons that land on a Thursday. So this is the second time that's happened. And last time, I think we had one person that stayed till midnight. So we'll be here till midnight. I think probably the two of us will be here till midnight this time. And if anybody else wants to stay, that's fine. If you want to leave, that's, of course, completely fine. And yeah, we'll just alternate sitting and walking, maybe do some different kinds of walking. May even be warm enough outside to do some outside walking, we'll see. But we'll also have the west part of the building available to us to walk inside. And we'll have an evening of practice together. So, any questions, comments, people that want to share their own devotional practices?
When I first started meditating, it was in the Hindu tradition, which is a bhakti or devotional, and we did kirtans and chanting, a lot of chanting. And my first experience, I was just at home, it was Krishna Das, and chanting along, and you know, I got extremely moved and emotional, and I just felt really, I felt a real transformation just because of the vibe, and it was a simple, you know, kind of repetitive chant. And I hadn't done it for a long time. I was doing it the other day, and the same thing happened. It just blew my mind. And I did it like, I don't know, by then 3 days in a row, and I was just really happy. It changed my entire feeling of my day and my approach. So I really think there's really something to that. In terms of its vibration and sound, it actually has a physical effect on one. And so If I had a better voice, I'd probably sing more, but it's terrible. So anyway, so I, you know, appreciate that element, bringing that in. I don't have as much access unless you know any particular singer or somebody's recorded the Pali. I do find that when they do it in English, I really had an adverse reaction. I was listening to one of the monks do a Dharma tape, and his other attendees were chanting it in English, and it was sounded exactly what I was brought up as a Greek Orthodox. They'd have this old man in the altar before the service and singing. I couldn't tolerate it. But I have chanted in Pali with a group who did their own version of it with the traditional instruments, and that was okay. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Boogie. Thank you, Rich. One thing I noticed when I was in Thailand, when you go to a temple, you must wear all white. When you wear different clothing, you know, if you're wearing a suit, you feel different than when you're wearing a t-shirt. I do. But so when you just can't go in casual. You have to wear all white. And another, that changes your attitude or mind. And another thing is when you go interview the monks, you know, you have an interview with the monk, you have to bow. I guess you don't have to. And that's really, Americans don't bow a lot to other people, you know, so it's a humbling experience. You bow a certain way to the Buddha, you bow a certain way to the monk, you know, so it has an effect on one's attitude.
Actually, my central practice is not this. It's a form of Nyingma, which is a Tibetan practice. So every time the new moon comes, unfortunately, I don't get together with my group in Berkeley all the time, but maybe three or four times a year, and we go through an extensive, maybe 4 hours worth of chanting, very specific chanting, that reemphasizes meditation and how it works for us as we see it from the Nyingma tradition. So it's very fortunate we have his description of what it means for him and his practice in detail. And so if anybody's ever interested, I can describe ours as well. And but it's very important because we re-emphasize how we practice, what we're after, what we're trying to achieve. And it goes stage by stage by stage during the night. And it happens when the moon is in this particular thing. And it's very ancient. It goes way back, maybe right around the time of the Buddha when this thing got going. So it's very ancient. And that makes for a very interesting feeling that you're part of this. And we chant either in Tibetan or in English. And thank God, English, you know. But. I just wanted to share that with you, that there are many ways of doing this, and they're very stimulating and help your practice a lot. So I'm not going to stay tonight, but I appreciate it.
Can you tell me that you post the days again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So by the way, the Thai monastic order that I go, you know, their monasteries that I go to, they've got this charted out. They use like a system, so that it's on the calendar that they use, and it doesn't always match up with what's happening in the sky. That's just the way that they do it. But basically, it's the new moon, and then the half moon. Other people probably know the official term, like the waxing moon and the waning moon, but it's new moon, half moon, full moon, and half moon. Does that answer the question? Or?
Yes. New moon, half moon, full moon,
mm-hmm.
and?
Half moon.
Half moon.
Yep.
Okay. So, 1 week.
Yeah, it is actually either 7 days between or 8 days between.
So you can't just look on my calendar at home and say, oh, it's a full moon, so it's your pasta day.
It might be off. Well, or you could do it that way. Or you could do it that way. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciated your talking about doing the precepts. You do it every morning before meditation, or you chant?
I chant the five precepts,
every morning.
And then on these lunar observance days, I do the modified version.
I have found
three extra ones.
That when I choose something, whether it's the refuges or if I do that before meditation, that the meditation I'm much better focused. I'm much more relaxed into it. I think it does have that huge value of reminding you why you're doing it, which does go beyond the secular, I think, into that devotional. And just as a side note, when I was still working, I tried working with a which was it? I guess it might have been the. Paramis, but so I had every month I had a new one, and I had it posted on my computer, and I didn't let myself. I mean, it kept me from getting away with it, you know. I can't write speech because I'd be having a really bad day, and I'd look at that and I go, "Oh, right." but those things really do bring you back to the practice in a big way.
After hearing you say that, I'm going to chant the precepts before meditating.
Do it after?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
okay. Could you please say the precepts you do in the morning?
Absolutely. So on the Upostha days, I say I will refrain from killing living beings, and I will refrain from taking that which is not given, and I will refrain from all sexual activity, and I will refrain from lying. I will refrain from taking intoxicants, which cloud the mind, and I will refrain from eating at inappropriate times. And I will refrain from adornment, beautification, and entertainment. And lastly, I will refrain from sleeping on a high and or luxurious place.
Can I just ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
I never heard that singing or dancing was against Buddhism before.
Oh, I don't think that it is. I don't think that it is against Buddhism. But this is a practice. It's a practice. It's an exercise. It's practicing restraint and mindfulness that I just take on every 7 or 8 days and along with the faces of the moon.
But this has nothing to do with the Buddhist practice, because singing and dancing, I always did, and I never heard of that. You can't do that.
Well, I don't think that it's that you can't do it. However, if you were to decide to ordain as a Buddhist monastic, then you would choose to not do that.
That's why the five precepts are called the five lay precepts.
Oh,
because they're sort of for the rest of us.
I see.
On most days. Ending with the fifth one about intoxicants.
Okay, thanks.
So I deeply appreciate both of you tonight, because I think this is what's been missing for me, because I can sit like a rock for hours. But the devotional side. And there, that is, and I was in Thailand, in Lao, this year, and did sit with monks on two different occasions. And young monks and very, very experienced monks. And it was, you know, I'm getting off topic here, but it was interesting to see the young monks. I'm talking 9, 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old boys, and just how they fidget, and they're just, they're trying so hard. And I actually met a Laotian monk who spent 22 years, four of which were in a cave, literally in a cave. And he didn't express the devotional side, but I'll express it for him. And that's, you know, it's not like he worshiped Buddha, but he aspired. And that's the word. So I hadn't planned on staying tonight, but I will. But I get up at 4, so I don't think I'll make it till midnight.
Okay, well, if there are no other comments for now, why don't we close with our devotional practice of dedicating the merit? So we so appreciate your practice and our shared intention here to not only refrain from harm, but to actually apply our lives to minimize and reduce, perhaps even eliminate the suffering of others. And while the practice of meditation may seem like an isolating activity, it is anything but. It's a recognition that there are no boundaries between us. And that just like us, all beings want to be happy. So whatever positive energies we have dedicated and generated here tonight, and that we will generate in our practice after the break, may we dedicate all of that to reducing the sufferings of all beings. May all beings be safe and protected, peaceful and happy, as healthy and as strong as their current circumstances allow. May all beings truly experience the ease of well-being. And may we and all beings be free of suffering. Thank you for your practice.